Thanks very much and good morning. And you can remember 10% of all that we're presenting today will give you a prize, because there's been a lot of very useful, very interesting information. And after Kyrgyzstan, I'm going to go back to Asia, and I mean from 97% deliveries in institutions, now we're going to go back to less than 10%. But we'll be presenting today Nepal and the progress that it has made in maternal and neonatal care. And again, the disclosure of no financial interest. So, very important, as we all know, maternal and neonatal mortality continues to be high in developing countries. The promotion of skilled birth attendants for maternal and also for newborn care, important interventions. But we know that in many countries in Asia, is a region in which, you know, those promises, you know, are still, you know, very far to be completed. I mean, it's just the rurality, the remoteness, and the lack of resources that hamper, you know, those efforts. So we know, and we have also some studies that are telling us that still community interventions can have an impact, but they are also kind of difficult to implement. For Nepal, as a background, we have high rates of home births and low skilled birth attendance, and still has a high rate of neonatal mortality among Asian countries. What we did is we used three data sets from DHS from 96 to 2006 and compared with other countries in the region, so you can have a sense of and comparison in the region. And we have also data available for births for the neonatal mortality. Here is something that we know more and more is happening and is actually prompting agencies to work more on. As you look at, in general, as child mortality, you can see that for Nepal, as well as for many other countries, the progress has been mostly in the latter years, where you have had 67% reduction, 52% reduction, compared to, for example, this is from zero to, this is the first month of life. And you can see compared to, you know, much, you know, less reduction, 22 or 15% reduction. And so that what happens in the end is that if at first you had neonatal mortality being 42% of the total childhood mortality, then it becomes much larger. And so at the end of the day, we know that we've made much progress in this latter, again, latter ages, but not on the first month of life. So that's, as we can see, very critical. Again, if you look at neonatal mortality rates per 1,000 live births, there's been reductions in several countries. Vietnam has done an incredible effort. And other countries, of course, even if they have less, you know, kind of individual type of reductions, but their rates for the country as a whole are much lower. And in Nepal, you can see 15% reduction only. So if we look at some determinants, you can see that still for the last DHS done in Nepal, 81% of all deliveries were delivered at home. So with that backdrop, you know, you can see the difficulty. How are you going to do to make sure that if you can get all those skilled birth attendants out there? And you can see here, unfortunately, only 1.6% of those deliveries were delivered by a skilled attendant. This is telling you again of the relative efforts by countries. And we just heard Indonesia, for example, which is amazing. Although only 40% of births are happen at the delivery at the health facility level, look at how, in general, births attended by a skilled provider jump up to 65%. Two-thirds, despite this, two-thirds of births of deliveries are attended. So that speaks of, I think, the theme that were for which we are gathered today, that you can have an outreach strategy that actually fills, you know, some of the vacuums. Unfortunately, Nepal has more or less the same percentage, meaning that those women who are fortunate to delivering the health facilities are also the ones who will have a skilled birth attendant. In other words, very little, almost nothing skilled birth attendant outside a facility. And again, something we haven't touched as yet, but in Nepal as well, in a few other countries that are mountainous, that are very remote, it's not even the TBAs who conduct the majority of deliveries. It's a relative or simply someone there present at home, you know. So it's a mother-in-law or some. You can see that 50% of all deliveries. So if we're talking about how to train TBAs, imagine now the challenge of training other, even non, I mean, we're not even talking about people who have had any access to the formal health system at all. Other indicators for postpartum care, you can see again those who have received postpartum care, again a third only, okay? So in comparison with Cambodia, another country that has taken long strides in improving the attendance surrounding delivery and in this case postpartum care. One interesting thing we were able to do, in not many surveys we have asked this, but in this one we disaggregated what was the postpartum care for the mother versus the postnatal care for the baby. And for some reason we see a huge disparity, whereas 23% among the whole, this is all you know, brought up to 100%, but so of the total postpartum or postnatal care, of the whole of mothers here, 23% had postpartum care, but only for the newborn 4%. It means that if there is a service that occurs after delivery, for some reason, the targeted person in this dyad would be the mother rather than the infant. Why? We would need to look into that. Why is that the situation? Now, for newborn care, I want to present also a few relatively new indicators that we have been using in recent surveys. For example, whether women or whether the provider, so women will be asked whether the provider used with them a clean home delivery kit. They are disposable and they are sterile and they are being distributed in many areas for home deliveries. And then about cord-cutting practices, and obviously this that we have also heard about drying and wrapping of the newborn, a very important condition, especially in mountainous or cool or cold areas. And it's good to see that there seems to be some, you know, less than half, but at least around 40% of those newborns who were either wrapped or dried right after delivery, which is an interesting situation. Use of clean home delivery kits, still 18%. And this, which is a common traditional practice, which unfortunately shouldn't be high, this should be, you know, the lowest as possible, is try to avoid giving bath within, you know, a short period after birth. In this case, you know, 3/4 of all newborns receive that bath. But interesting, we saw 18%, but, you know, between the three surveys, we've seen a big increase. So it means that it's something that needs more effort, but in some ways it's catching on. I mean, you can see obviously the difficulty of distributing and making sure that those kits are used properly. That's another challenge. So anyway, so steady progress in Nepal in trying to address maternal and also childhood mortality. What we have reviewed, that there is less childhood mortality, but still neonatal bears the brunt of mortality, so more effort to be done there. And then for some reason, less newborn than postpartum care for the mother. And obviously we need to work on that thing about the bath after birth. So I think from the data that we have analyzed, we can say that, yes, in Nepal, despite the remoteness and the rurality, a huge effort would be to try to increase the skilled birth attendance. So we're not even saying, okay, let's have everyone deliver at a health facility. But through outreach efforts and interventions, one could increase the percentage of women who at least have this access to life-saving skills. And in the meantime, we know that there can be, as has been said here, community involvement. In our case, most of utmost importance, because there will be places, as you've seen here, half of all women delivering at home will not even be approached by a TBA. So to have a member of the community who knows about the nearest center, who knows about birth preparedness, who can effect those referrals if need be, that would be also of utmost importance. Obviously, the TBAs that are present, as we know, to train them to recognize the dangers, to use the safe delivery kits. Of course, we can see that each one is tapping a different cause of maternal and neonatal mortality. So prevention of infection, and obviously to avoid some of the non-recommended practices like, you know, early immediate bathing of the newborn. Okay, that's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Alfredo. So I'd like now, we have about 30 minutes. I'd like to thank all the presenters, too, for staying on schedule and really moving the session along. I really appreciate that. But now I'd like to open it up for questions. We have about 25 minutes left for questions. And I would like to get this microphone untaped from this thing so we could pass it around. So I'll try that while someone asks a question. Perhaps, yeah. Okay, you can either come up here or talk loud.
Question is that why women who receive voucher didn't use it, because they're not that they can use it. That was another question. You know, we extensively did it. We did in-depth interviews with those voucher recipients, those use voucher, and those who don't use voucher. The primary reason they said they don't feel that to go to the health facility to deliver. So their voucher was not used for delivery purposes, but voucher was, as you have seen, that voucher has been used for, you know, ANC care, PNC care. So still they don't have the awareness that they have to go to a trained facility or trained provider to a trained provider for delivery. They still think home births are, you know, accepted. Yeah, it is a two sample, so it's not the match sample. So definitely, in statistically, there might be some reporting bias. But if you take the overall picture, you know, the straightforward question, I don't think that much reporting bias are there. But still, might be, you know, I can't answer that question because individuals are not the same.
But you asked women as reported themselves whether they use
the services. They were asked, you know, whether they have used these services. But at the same time, we have matched those, you know, reporting with the service statistics. As for the time, you know, we have not given that information. It matched reasonably well. You know, those who say that they have taken ANC care or the PNC care, we also match that whether they have been taken ANC care and PNC care from the health facilities. Yeah.
Someone at home, like in the case of Nepal, someone, you know, a family member could do it, as opposed to putting resources.
Yes, perhaps you could answer that question. And maybe other panelists have some experience with active management at third stage of labor in their countries. I would also like to add to that question with your, if you could actually answer also some of the logistics of providing the TBAs with the misoprostol. Mm-hmm. And I know as an obstetrician, we like to use that to stimulate labor and things like that. And I just would like to know how you can ensure that that use is used correctly and not in a harmful way.
Okay. Lots of questions to answer then. So I guess we're going to start with a discussion about active management of third stage labor and misoprostol. One comment I can add to that is that misoprostol, since it is a uterotonic, can be used in the active management of third stage labor where oxytocin can't be used. So just to provide an example, Dr. Indola Prada, who is a colleague of Paige and myself, did a study in 2006 using misoprostol in the active management of third stage labor in a very busy Egyptian hospital. And one of the findings of the study that I think is very interesting is that in a busy hospital setting, misoprostol can provide a very useful alternative to nurse midwives because it's a very simple regimen. It's 3 tablets immediately after delivery, making sure that there's not a second infant in the woman. So, and whereas when you looked at use of uterotonics such as oxytocin or ergometrine in active management, there was actually a variety of regimens that ended up being using and different timing of administration, and there was worries that there was not proper storage of the injectable uterotonics. So I just want to add that misoprostol can be used in the active management of third stage labor as well. And then in terms of competing priorities, it's difficult to say. There is a lot of momentum behind active management of third stage labor, but again, that is, I would have to say, a facility-focused intervention. And misoprostol is, in my personal opinion, a complementary strategy where we have prevention of postpartum hemorrhage in facilities using active management of third stage labor, and we can complement that with home-based use of misoprostol when active management is infeasible due to absence of a skilled provider or absence of proper storage of the drug. And in that way, we could potentially protect all women against PPH, which I think is the ultimate goal in the immediate term while we're waiting to scale up an increased skilled attendance at birth, which is another ultimate goal I think most people would have. So I think then I should start addressing your question. Just to preface that with the fact that misoprostol has a variety of obstetric purposes. It is a uterotonic, so it causes the uterus to contract, so it can be used to induce labor. Those contractions are the same thing that stops postpartum bleeding. And it also can be used as an abortifacient because it causes the uterus to contract and so thus can expel the contents. So operationalizing it, I think in terms of how we've approached it, with community-based use, we do extensive training with our TBAs. For the Kigoma study, it's a little different because it was treatment, and I think there's kind of a momentum towards prevention of PPH because you don't have to wait to identify it. You can immediately act and be a little proactive. So we cover safe delivery practices. We covered did a lot of in-depth interviews and focus groups and participant participation on how to hit that threshold of PPH. And then it's just very rigorous reinforcement of the message of timing and route and dosage. And in terms of other demonstration and community-based projects, it's not just focusing that education on route, dose, and timing on the people, just on the woman or just on the TBA, but doing a community-based approach to that. And so educating partners and educating family members about the drug when you use it and how you use it. So, I guess.
Did you give it to the TBAs or to the mothers?
In this Kigoma study, it was given to the TBAs. And so it was actually a very, I think, beautiful system because the TBAs were paired with the health facility, the local regional hospital. And so they met with supervisors on a monthly basis where they kind of reported to them how many deliveries they attended, how much misoprostol they had used. They would restock. So there was accountability with the healthcare system in that way. And then again, when a woman needed referral who delivered at home with our TBAs, the TBA goes with her to the health facility, tells the healthcare provider what happened, is with the woman while she's receiving care. So it kind of joined those, instead of keeping TBAs out at the home and the providers in the health facility, it kind of bridged that gap and kind of created almost the, you know, the home to hospital continuum of care, which is nice.
The health facility was probably part of the study itself, and that goes away. There's still that connection?
That's what our evaluation. Part of it was to look at that as like, okay, now that the strict control of the study environment is over, what happens? And what I described was continuing to occur. The TBA still had their monthly meeting with their supervisor where they got their tablets and, you know, handed it. They kept logs of the women they delivered with and handed them over. And so that system maintained itself.
And also that was one of the key failings in the past of not working on developing better relationships between TBAs and SBAs. And it was kind of done in a vacuum, and as a result, the TBAs were not keen to refer women to SBAs, and there was just a lot of problems in that relationship. So that's one of the learnings, I think, in recent years, that people have recognized that this is essential to build these relationships, train them together, or do whatever you can to create a relationship of trust.
Following up on your comments just now, because I was going to ask while there is, that's important to develop the relationship between the midwife and the TBA, and that's probably why you might say, well, maybe we should continue using the TBAs. But at the same time, if you look at the statistics from most sub-Saharan Africa, most women two unstable cares, so having visits. But you look at the deliveries, I think we haven't looked at why they're not coming back to deliver. And should we use that to justify what we're now doing, saying, well, you know, we should now continue to train TBAs or have them provide this hospital? Or do, you know,
well, both things have to be addressed. I mean, why are they not coming back? Why are they not feeling comfortable to deliver in the facility even after they've gone for ANC? And there's been a lot of qualitative research that has come out in the last 10 years talking about those reasons. So I think it has to be a dual strategy, both to address those reasons why women are not going, and a lot of it has to do with logistical stuff. You know, they have kids at home they have to take care of right until the last minute, and then suddenly they're in labor. So some of it is transportation, distance, and a whole bunch of complicated things. But the ones that are addressable, the ones that have to do with the quality of services or the way they're treated when they go there, or the environment, those are the things that we can work on definitely at the facility level, and at the same time do something for the women who are just not going to make it to the facility for delivery.
I'm wondering if we could hear from you about Indonesia and about the relationship of TBAs to skilled attendants and use of misoprostol. Would you like to use your microphone?
Last year's study showed that even the mothers go for the antenatal care to midwives, the delivery still goes to traditional birth attendants. Mothers mentioned that the reason why they go to the traditional birth attendant is because the purse is cheap, you know, it's economic effective. To the birth to the TBAs is only like $5, $10, and if you go to midwives, then it cost minimum about $30, so it's huge difference. And also, midwife usually who's assigned in village is still young. They just graduate, which is like 20 or maximum is 30. And TBA is, you know, is 50. So they believe that it will be safer even to this person who's experienced, who has a lot of experience. And also, TBA is well known in the community because they know from their child until they, you know, that in the long term. But midwife is just assigned in the village is someone that they don't know, and even sometimes they don't cannot speak local language. Indonesia have 200 local language. Which is that's also a bit difficult, you know. Some of the mothers cannot speak Indonesian, and they only speak local language. And these midwives, you know, cannot speak local language properly. So there's also barriers there. And also the important things that the mother state is. Traditional birth attendants provide traditional ceremonies. This is that midwives cannot perform. And Indonesian, you know that culturally, when mothers just delivery, we have some ceremonies. And each of the island, each of the province and district have different kind of traditional ceremony. So it's also a traditional birth attendant who is only a package. You pay your $5, but you get this package with the ceremony traditional things, but not with the midwives. So, but we have approaches that the midwife and traditional and TBA should go together to the mothers who need their assistance. So there's a, like for example, through the community approaches, we encourage community to through the village leader, for example, release a decree that midwives should work together with the TBA. So like for example, if community pay $30, then TBA get $10 and midwives get $20, like that. So anytime when this TBA want to go to mothers who want to for labor, so she can call the midwives because she knows that she will get the money anyway. And then the midwives also the same. They call the TBA, so it's less like partnership. Delivery service is only by midwives, but after that, you know, for the traditional things, massage and ceremony, then it's part of the is assigned to the TBAs. Thank you.
What about TBAs and misoprostol? Is that being used at all?
Well, we conducted study in West Java province for misoprostol, which is 2004. We're not the policy, national policy is not really, you know, that's not implement yet, you know, that's for the misoprostol. We can just study in 2004, and yes, Jepang got trained traditional village midwives to give the misoprostol to the mothers, but not with the TBA. So it's still with the skill. But and then until now it's not become a national policy. So there is still contra, you know, in the central government of using misoprostol. Thank you.
Culture, tradition, and other factors, that there's this huge drop, and now, you know, happening is that if there is this access, and medical care cannot continue to be ritualistic. And this is the call from WHO, that now whoever has, if you like, the privilege and the momentous of seeing this woman needs to have all the, if you like, power and knowledge, but knowing that probably she won't come for delivery. So that she has to have all the, I mean, where to get a safe delivery kit, as we know, the birth preparedness, you know, can you have any transportation arranged, prearranged, I mean, the money, all that we've heard. So I think the break might happen if we, all the providers, recognize that this is a moment, this is an opportunity not to be missed, as we have talked about from planning and other opportunities. So this, because once again, I mean, the care is there, but, you know, the delivery over time and cost.
Because I have a question about the EPH evaluation in Tanzania. I was wondering if you had considered training the TBAs to provide misoprostol routinely to all women postpartum prior to the onset of excessive bleeding, as it's been in the context of AMSOL and the support of
okay, yes. So Tanzania was kind of a special case because the momentum with misoprostol has kind of moved towards prevention as opposed to treatment. The special case with Tanzania is that there is this local garment called conga, and two of these congas soaked with blood equals almost exactly 500 milliliters of blood, which is the threshold of PPH. So we actually had this great tool that was culturally appropriate. Women were already using it to collect blood loss after delivery. And so if you'll remember, that initial study was conducted in 2003. So that was kind of while we were still in the stages of will misoprostol be used for treatment or prevention. And so since then, it's moved towards prevention because most contexts lack that tool. And even in clinical settings here, it can be visual estimation. So moving forward, there's a project we're starting in Tanzania where it will be used for prevention. So, but that's the reason why it was treatment in this case. Yeah.
How strong is the evidence usefulness of misoprostol for prevention?
The evidence is quite strong. In fact, the WHO recommends, in the absence of active management of third stage labor with oxytocin, that misoprostol should be used. So the evidence is quite strong, and it's comparable efficacy. So.
Yes, in the back.
I have a question about data about the indicator on delivery cadence. And I was just curious if you had, you're also asking about the availability of clean delivery cadence in the country. Because clean delivery kits are not currently available in all parts of Nepal. And I don't think they're available on a consistent basis in any country around the world.
Yeah, I think it's a good point, and I think that's why it's reflected in the still relatively low percentage of use. You know, if you have 13, 14, 18%, you know, that's, I mean, it still begs, you know, for more, much more effort. I think the, I mean, it's like mosquito nets, you know, frankly, that what you want is, do you want to deliver it, but with a proper or at least minimum counseling on how to use it, because again, you know, in the hands of somebody who has never seen, I mean, I'm again thinking Nepal, you know, 50% of relatives, I mean, they're going to be there. They will be attending that delivery, but can you effectively ask them to use, open this package and use, for example, this sterile scissors or blade, you know, that would be great. But I'm pretty sure they would be even like taken aback, you know, just by seeing something that is so Western and so different. So I think that is the effort. That is the effort then to put it out in sufficient numbers and to put the training behind it and not just release it as a thing.
Because it seems
that
the kit in Nepal has actually been designed for home use by relatives or TBAs or whomever is in the world. So it actually is very culturally appropriate, and I think it's not something that would be overwhelming.
think it's just one indicator. I think, in fact, even it was put in there in the DHS. It's one of the few places where it has been added as a country-specific indicator because the agencies were very active in promoting it. But it's not everywhere. Yeah, I think you're right. You have to interpret the numbers and to see. I mean, is this something? I mean, in 10 years, it's gone only up to 14%. Do we want to keep promoting it, or is that just one of several other experiments? But you're right.
Well, it's 12 o'clock now, so we should close the session. You can come up and ask the speakers some questions afterwards. I think we all leave with a sense that traditional birth attendants still have a role in maternal care, and they will, and we'll still have to keep working that out, and maybe next year we can talk about this again. Thank you, and thanks to the speakers.
Why are you studying?
No, I'm not.
আচ্ছা আপনি কোনো কাজকর্ম করেন?
আমি
Thank you.
Thank you.